I also work with the women HIV study called WISE in Chicago, and I also do some work in Rwanda, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. The title of my talk is Listening to Youth in WEAC, the Challenge of Adhering to Antiretroviral Medication. So this is the other talk on HIV that we'll have the opportunity. No financial relationship to disclose. In terms of background, many of the people in this room have come to our previous panels related to WEACT, but just to refresh your memory, Women's Equity and Access to Care and Treatment, or WEACT, has provided HIV care in Kigali, Rwanda since 2004. We were called in by women's associations in Rwanda at a time when there was not HIV medications available for people there, and we were asked to fast-track care. It was an emergency time. We responded to that request, and over the next 7 years, we're able to build a program where we now see just under 3,000 adults and children in two different sites, and about half of those patients are on antiretroviral medications. It's a very full, comprehensive program with clinic visits and medications, including family planning and hospitalization support. We do HIV testing and counseling in our clinic site as well as in the community. We have a special day every Wednesday where our services are dedicated just to youth and children. We have support groups, including trauma counselors and psychologists, able to see people individually, one-on-one, as well as in groups. Small legal services to help with advocacy among paralegals in the associations that we work with. Our partner associations number now around 15 who bring their patients and help guide us to what would be the best needed services as the program has developed. We have an income generation program where people are trained and supported in making goods, including crafts and beads and other things like that to help supplement income. Nutritional support, especially for youth, called a Sosoma program where we provide a sort of Rwandan known porridge for any child who's on antiretroviral therapy as well as their family each month. So that's sort of the major program, but what I'd like to talk about today is what we're doing with youth and what incredible challenges we've discovered. And I think it really relates to the work that Lisette talked about. As a sort of thinking about sort of very vulnerable youth in a under-resourced setting and what can we do. So just to set the stage, we have a large group of kids under 12 who we spend a lot of energy in terms of Sunday support groups, giving them a playtime and some nutrition, and we have counselors talking with their parents on a regular basis. But what I'm going to talk about today is the larger group of about 300 youth between 13 and 24, which about two-thirds of them are on antiretroviral therapy, and sort of discuss the program that we developed for them. We noticed that there was not a great amount of sensitivity to the youth by the nurses and counselors. The kids seemed like kids that we were familiar with in terms of not wanting to do whatever they were told to do and being quite, you know, autonomous and having minds of their own. And that wasn't appreciated by the nursing and counseling staff in the Rwandan clinic. It's all Rwandan staff, the clinic. So we decided to figure out a way to make a more youth-friendly environment in the clinic. And that included sensitizing staff, and turns out that Mary Fabry, who's our next speaker, is a psychologist who'll be talking about work she's doing in Chicago, but she also works with me in Rwanda, and she helped us sort of provide that kind of sensitization. We next wanted to find out what the youth who come to the clinic wanted, because as Lisette talked about, you have to sort of meet people where they're at, and that was our way of trying to figure out where the kids were at. And then we wanted to figure out if we could come up with some interventions to increase retention in the clinic as well as antiretroviral medication adherence, because we were seeing some really serious problems with kids having higher and higher viral loads, mainly lower and lowered CD4 counts, doing poorly, not taking their medications. So we used a different variety of methods. We had some focus groups about a year ago where we invited 5 to 10 kids to come to talk with us, facilitated by our trauma counselors, and sort of we transcribed their responses and I'm going to share some of them with you. We did a sort of standard psychosocial assessment with about 40 questions to get a sense of what the kids' living situations were. We categorized the kids by their adherence, by clinical signs and clinicians' appraisal. We did some more in-depth interviews of the groups that were most adherent, sort of adherent, and least adherent. And then we did some facilitated group intervention of kids who were poorly adherent, kids who were sort of okay adherent, and kids who were the best at adherence to see if they could talk with each other to help each other arrive at what would be the best methods to stay on medications. So the focus group results, we asked the kids, why do you like coming to the clinic? And they said, well, it's nice to meet with and get advice from the doctors, counselors, and nurses. They liked meeting other kids their own age and to have who had the same status. And this was a little bit before we started the single day program for youth and children. They liked being able to get their medications. They thought they were well received in the clinic. They felt that they had quick service and they were asked how things were going at school, so they were attended to. They felt the staff listened to them and that the staff seemed like friends to them. But then, of course, when we asked what you didn't like about the clinic, all the converses came out. It would be better if I only had to come once every 4 months. I don't like coming so often. I don't like running into people I know. Sort of their confidentiality was sort of blown. I don't like meeting older youth that we act who have not accepted their status. So kids who were sort of hiding where they were at were discouraged other youth. I didn't like waiting in the clinic for a long time. I would arrive late, be given another appointment. There wasn't enough flexibility. Sometimes I'm late. They ask me so many questions instead of just providing services. So you can tell the kids were telling us what they really thought. When we asked them about taking their medications, like what were the problems, do you take them regularly? They said, yes, I take them twice a day, but it's difficult to take them at the right time. Yes, I take them, but I can't always take them at the right time. Instead of taking them twice a day, I take them once a day. So during the week, I may only take them 5 times. I don't take them regularly when I'm at school, especially because I live far away from Kigali, and it's difficult to come all the way here to get the medicine. But during vacations, I take them regularly. So not the kind of adherence we'd want. And so we said, well, what kind of information could we give youth about HIV and about medicines and clinical visits that would make you or others more likely to come and take the medicines? And they said, encourage them to take their medications and to join a support group. Come to tell people to come to your appointments to avoid consequences. Tell them life goes on, invite them to join a support group. I would orient them to counseling and sensitize them to respect their appointment and the instructions of the nurses. Tell them they must share their experience with others and fight against infecting others. So we sensed that there was a need to sort of have kids together to sort of share and to get the best response. We then looked at about, I think we have now 217 youth, asked them sort of some standard questions to figure out what their lives were like, and I have them broken out by the age group. So the groups we're most interested in right now really are the 16 to 19 and the older than 20, though we have the most in the younger group. Women make up the larger percentage in all the groups, which is true. I mean, it shouldn't be true in the group that was perinatally infected and the under 12 group, but pretty soon after that, because of sexual women become a larger group, and maybe because of entering care. I mean, both of those things, I think, show an increase in women compared to the boys we're seeing and young men. And you can see that as the older group, it's less perinatally infected. There is an issue of contaminated needles that is thought about in Rwanda as occurring. And of course, the people's own sexual habits as they get older are responsible. This is a big slide, but I want you to note that so both parents or one biologic parent, you can see, covers about 60%. So 40% of the kids, even this large group of 11 to 19-year-olds, don't live with one or both parents. In total, basically, almost 45% of the kids have one or two parents, that, well, both parents who have died. School is attended in the younger groups by most of the kids. Alcohol is really not a big a problem as I think it is in the States, nor is drug use, nor is smoking. In terms of sexual activity, the older kids were more likely to say that they were sexually active. Girls at younger ages were said to be more sexually active. I think that reflects behavior patterns of girls have both being forced to have sex as well as having sex earlier for transactional sex in order to survive. You could see the condom use for those who were sexually active wasn't very great in terms of always using. Sexual abuse is a big problem among the kids over 16, a horrendously big problem, and a history of rape also. I can't move this down, but you could, there it is. Quite important, with first age of rape being around 11 to 14. Kids felt minimal amount of pressure to have sex and felt forced to have transactional sex as they got older. Transactional sex is having sex to get money or shelter in this thing, in this town. So we then did these in-depth interviews to ask the kids who we sort of had put in different groups, well, what was it like to find out you were infected? How could that help us understand better to take medications? How are you doing now taking medications? A number of kids talked about feeling totally rejected for being HIV infected. Before I knew I was HIV positive, when I would pick somebody's plate, they would push me away. This isn't a family, after being sort of not his own biologic parent. Or when I would take a fork from some other kid, they would prevent me from doing so. He didn't know he was infected at this point. So they started transferring me from one family to another, to one uncle to another uncle. Maybe one uncle would receive me because he didn't know the problem. After finding out, he would transfer me to another. So that's why I decided to go to the orphanage, because of the life that I had. Rwanda is a very poor country. It's very hard for families to take on children in addition to their own children, and sometimes people's best efforts don't come through. The kids were really upset for finding out that they were infected later than they had wanted to find out. So just so you get a sense, it wasn't until 2006 in Rwanda that kids under 18 were tested. So you have a large group of kids just finding out who are either perinatally infected or infected by their own behaviors later than you would maybe in the States. This kid said, I was living with my grandmother and my mother was living in Burundi. My mother was also living with HIV/AIDS. When I was really getting weak, I developed some swelling in my arms. So my mother took me to the same doctor and she told me, whenever you're asked questions, respond correctly. Don't hide anything. I was taken for a blood test and the results were brought to me. I was being asked whether there was anyone I knew who had AIDS, like a friend, but I said no, I didn't know exactly how a person with HIV/AIDS looks like. I was asked, how do you behave if you find that you're already HIV positive? Then I felt like I was being bombarded with a lot of questions. Then I started thinking that there was something wrong with me. I told him, obviously I would not be very happy because I would want to have a good life, because at this age and energy, I would not be very happy because I want to live a good life, because the age and energy I had and my future plans would somehow be cut if I found I was HIV positive. I didn't even want to hear somebody telling me I had HIV. And we continued talking, and finally they told me. It hurt me most that when I was already grown up and was not being informed by my mother but by somebody else. That's why I was so shocked. And then after getting out, I would not accept it. It took me almost a year without going to school, without eating well. I found that my blood contained HIV. When I was told that, I felt as if I was struck by lightning. I later started to accept it, and life went on. Not a story dissimilar from many we've heard in the States. I think some of what this youngster has shared with us has helped us go along with actually the Rwandan plan to ensure that children below 12 are told of their diagnosis by the time they are 12. Of course, individual characteristics should play into that. But kids do want to know and can deal with the infection earlier. So then we had a facilitated group intervention where we had kids. About the clinical staff feels that 20% of the youth that we see are not doing well with taking medications. That probably another 20% are doing okay, and 60% are doing well. And that's reflected in their CD4 counts and their attention to coming to clinic visits. But 20% are doing poorly. So we took kids from each of those three groups and put them together. And this is a summary of what was found in our group settings. And we've only held one of these group interventions so far. We have three others planned at the times of school vacations for the kids. The obstacles that were talked about were disclosure problems, big time, that people just felt bad, uncomfortable disclosing to a best friend or to their school principals. They were ashamed to take their medicine daily as they needed to hide it, especially at boarding schools. They definitely talked about feeling depressed and hopeless. They felt that the number of pills in the second line regimen, which means they'd already been resistant to the first, was overwhelming for them. Successful strategies that youth shared with others was to confide in school authorities in order to have a safe place and time to take the medication. That people thought that helped. There's a lot of youth who go to boarding school, publicly funded boarding school in Rwanda. That's why boarding school is an issue here. They felt you needed to find something to eat to take along with the medicine, and that really helped them tolerate it. To understand that the medicine was essential to take, even if it is difficult, so that sort of sense of knowing what the medicine would do and prevent was very important, and what positive effects medicine has for you. To try to not let the anger that the kids had against their families and others make you miss taking the medication. So to let kids explore how angry they were to sort of get there. And then remember that it's their life, not anyone else's, and that they should take responsibility for their own life. I mean, very difficult issues, I think, to go through, and we hope that the next few facilitated groups will even give us more information. So the lessons, I think, from our project was that youth with HIV in Rwanda, I think like youth everywhere, have difficulties adhering to antiretroviral therapy. Specifically, lack of disclosure, depression, poverty, and feeling angry about having HIV are major obstacles to accepting the diagnosis and to taking medications. And we hope that group interventions that allow youth to share experiences to help each other will be a successful strategy for taking medications regularly. I think that's it.